And as I said, it's reviews almost all the way this evening. And we're going to start with films. We didn't have them yesterday because, of course, we gave you our Sean O'Casey special with Druid from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. But in our movies this evening then, first up will be the latest installment in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Heroes Turtles franchise, which is still something that trips so easily off the tongue all these years later, isn't it? This new one is called Mutant Mayhem, where the Turtle Brothers face down an army of mutants. That sounds familiar. Talk to Me is an Australian supernatural horror where a group of teenagers discover how to conjure spirits using an embalmed hand. And The Beanie Bubble, a comedy drama that tells the origin story of the Beanie Babies, the soft toys that took the world by storm in the 1990s. And to give us their views tonight, we have Gemma Cray and Chris Wasser. Let us start with, here we go again, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And the title of this latest in the franchise, Mutant Mayhem. Monday sees the release of the latest adventures of Leonardo, Donatello, Raphael and Michelangelo, better known as the aforementioned Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I wonder how many times I'm going to have to say it. In Mutant Mayhem, the pizza-loving comic book heroes hope to be accepted as normal teenagers while facing down an army of mutants. Gemma, these turtles have been around, let's face it, for a while. The original of the series back in 1990, believe it or not, the animated series. Do you need to have a big knowledge to come to the turtles right now? Or is it basically, look, they're teenagers, they want to be boys. That's kind of been the story all along in some ways, hasn't it?
It is. In many ways, it's a coming of age story. And luckily, they have really kind of gone back to the origin story. So you've taken you right back to Inception and spent a lot of time in flashback explaining the very complex situation in which they were created. And that is a bunch of radioactive goo fell on some turtles. And then you had the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The end. Yeah. And the thing about it is, every single time I see those words written down in my mind, I go, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So yeah. We've no problem. Because yeah. You spent your childhood. And
were you of a similar type of setup going in to see this film, Chris?
When I was a kid, I was two when the original live action film came out. And I was actually the right age around about that time for the TV cartoon. So I loved the Turtles, Sean. I had Turtles duvet covers and everything. But at the same time, I've never seen a Turtles film that's been good. You know, the comic books were good, the cartoons were good, but the live action films were always a little bit too creepy, and there was something quite sinister about, yeah, you know, the costumes and trying to, you know, make that big screen live action cartoon. I think it works best in cartoon form, and that's what Seth Rogen, the writer...
I was going to say, enter Jeff Rowe, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. We're not in any kind of scary territory here. We're in... happy, funny place, I'm guessing.
Yeah, definitely. And Seth Rogen, I mean, we're seven films in, but this is a reboot. But Seth Rogen and Jeff Rowe, they're the first guys that have come along and said, it's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Let's focus, because the film's never done this before. Let's focus on the fact that they are kids. Let's actually bring in, you know, largely newcomers in terms of the teenage actors that are portraying the turtles. And let's make a coming of ager. And there's actually a shot in this film where the turtles are sneaking out from Splinter at night and they go to a public screening of Bueller. And I think that's the filmmaker setting out their stall. They're saying, okay, you've seen other superhero films, but ours is more in the John Hughes kind of vein.
Right. Well, let's have a listen. I'm guessing this scene that we're about to listen to is just after they've been out to the cinema. They're caught sneaking back into to home when they were supposed to go shopping and come straight back home. Of course, they didn't. Their dad, a rat called Splinter, played by Jackie Chan, makes it clear he is not happy.
Boys, where have you been? I've been freaking out.
We're sorry, Dad.
It was this one. It was his cat, and you know I'm scared of cats, so.
Yeah, we did have to.
Wait a second. You said you would go shopping, then come right back. Where were you?
Nothing.
Look, we're really sorry, Splinter. Some of the guys want to see a movie, and I try to talk them out of it.
Leo!
What? You watch a movie with a human?
You ratted us out.
Hey, don't use that word that way.
I mean, it's 2023.
Sorry, Dad.
So there we go. I'm guessing all of the dialogue is as overlapped, if I can put it politely, as that is, Gemma.
Yeah, there's a great characterization of the four turtles. So Leonardo is, you know, like they really kind of lean into the stereotype. So Donatello, he's like the classic nerd. Michelangelo's is the cowabunga dude, as we all remember from the cartoons. But, you know, he's quite innocent and he's kind of the youngest one. They really set them up like these kind of charismatic brothers that bicker and get annoyed at one another. And Raphael is this kind of like big angry bully as well, which really kind of sits in well with an exaggerated version, but also sits in well with their characterization as teenagers and being angry and feeling misunderstood and alone. And each one has a different set of wants. They're very well realized, and there's a lot of depth there. So even if you watch it as an adult, you can enjoy it.
Mm. And in terms of those characterizations, it's young teenage actors that are playing the four: Leonardo, Donatello, Raffaello, Michelangelo, Nicholas Cantu, Mika Abbey, Brady Noon, and Seamon Brown Jr. I don't know if we know any of those young teenage actors, and is it important? Do they give performances that make us want to know them, Chris?
They do, actually. Yeah, one of the performers, Brady Noon, I had known from playing a child character in Boardwalk Empire. But aside from that, I think they brought in about 1,000 kids and auditioned them. And again, Seth Rogen, who co-wrote the screenplay, was kind of, he was overseeing the whole project with his producer pal Evan Goldberg and Jeff Rowe, and they wanted them to be teenagers. They wanted them to sound like teenagers. And also, I think all of the voice characters here, all of the voice actors, they all recorded their lines, if not all at the same time, they were all brought in as a sort of, they were acting opposite each other.
So they weren't just doing their lines in isolation.
Yeah, that really helps. And they've also, I mean, this is Seth Rogen, so he's also brought in his famous pals. You've got Rose Byrne, you've got John Cena, Paul Rudd. Maya Rudolph is in there. So there's,
and Ice Cube is in there as well.
Ice Cube playing apparently they said to Ice Cube that the name of the villain here is Superfly, and he said sold straight away. the biggest death that this film it's the best Turtles presentation that we've had, but it also a significant death to a different franchise, and that's actually Spider-Man. And Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse plays such an influence here, because the animation is that storybook CG, sketchy, looks like the inside of a high schooler's art book, that sort of level of animation.
I'm hearing excitement, and it's probably worth mentioning as well, Gemma, in an age when body image is so much to the fore, and given that the target audience here seems to be teenagers, they handle that whole area quite well.
They depict different physiologies very well. They depict different body types in this very natural, very kind of open way. It was like, if the women aren't kind of like stick figures with these enormous curves, the men aren't these like ridiculously muscly triangles. I mean, if you remember the live action ones, like they're actually very buff turtles.
Yeah.
You know, and even within the turtles, they have different body types. Like Michelangelo is quite slight. Donatello is really tall and broad. And then Raphael is stocky. So like, it's lovely to see that sort of diversity of physicality represented on screen in a way that's authentic and feels true to the character.
That
as well.
Sounds very positive from both of you. Stars from you, Gemma?
Oh, four. Definitely.
Four from you. What are you saying, Chris?
Smart, funny, inventive, pops off the screen. Probably the best I've seen of a four.
We'll put all of those words on the poster, I'm sure, if they heard them. Smart, funny and inventive. You can see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem in cinemas from Monday, as I said. Let's move on then to film number two. Australian horror thriller called Talk To Me follows a group of, here we go again, teenagers who discover the powers of an embalmed hand, which lets them conjure up spirits. It's all innocent and fun until, of course, it isn't. Is this a kind of a Ouija board come alive in the form of an embalmed hand type of thing?
Yeah, it is. That is exactly a different metaphor for that, except for the hand is also a metaphor for drugs and teenagers sharing drugs. And it's very, very unsubtle in the way that all those teenage films are. It's fun that it's set in suburban Australia as well, because there's so much vibrancy. There's a lot of swearing. They run over a kangaroo in the beginning of the film as well. And like, you know, that doesn't sound exactly like you'd expect to do as it's dying. And that's sort of a plot point. So it's very, very Australian in tone, which is enjoyable. It starts off at a teenage house party that's interrupted by a gruesome stabbing. And then that's their prologue. Then we kind of get right into the action and we introduce our lead characters. There's Jade, who lives with her brother.
Played by Alexandra Jensen. Yes. Yeah.
And then we have Mia, who's the star of the show, is Sophie Wilde, yeah. Plays her. And they're best friends. And Mia's constantly over at Jade's house because her mother has just passed away in these very mysterious circumstances. So she's still sort of struggling to process this loss. She's kind of staying away from her big empty house with her dad, where all the tragedy happens. And in a weird way, this hand kind of helps her lose herself. Yeah. So she's very prone
to be addicted. So Mia is the one who has lost her mother. Yeah. And then the friend is Jade. And Jade has a younger brother as well, doesn't he? Riley, played by Joe Bird. Let's have they have a conjuring party where they need to conjure things up. Let's have a listen to what happens when they start their conjuring party.
Look, does anyone else want to volunteer?
I'll do it.
You want to do it?
Sit down, Mia.
What are we playing?
It's nothing, Riley. Haley's tricked everyone.
All right, somebody time it. As soon as she lets it in, it cannot go for more than 90 seconds. Am I clear?
What happens after 90 seconds?
They'll want to stay.
And if you die while they're in you, do I have you forever?
So late.
Hey, I'm just relaying what I've been told, okay?
Candles.
Light the candle to open the door. Blow it out to close it. Put your hand on it. Now say, talk to me.
Talk to me.
Shouldn't have said talk to me. Kind of know that, even though I haven't seen the movie. I get a sense that talk to me is not a good phrase to use in this film, Chris. I was asking to maybe just take us a little bit further on from that then. That's the group of teenagers, and we can hear it's all good innocent fun until it stops being innocent fun. How quickly does it stop being innocent fun, and does it become very scary fun?
Oh, Gemma will have to talk you through this one, Sean. I actually didn't see talk to me. I'll sit outside.
Would you not just try?
He does have encyclopedia knowledge about the filmmakers.
Oh, right, okay. Well, so Gemma, sorry, that was my mistake. Take it on from there then. How quickly does it become a big problem?
So what's very interesting about the structure of this film is this scene happens very, very early on into the action, into the narrative. So what you hear is her, you know, taking the hand. She says, talk to me. And that kind of spurs on the visual of the spirit in front of her. And then when she says, let me in, or I let you in, that's when she becomes possessed. And actually, the possession is a high feeling. Like they get a high from this. The ghost takes over the body and talks to the group of partygoers. So that's sort of the premise. And these teenagers do that out of habit as a sort of form of recreational drug taking, like at house parties and things like that. And they film it, they put it up online, and that's sort of the initial premise. But that's set up so early. Then what you have is sort of the breakdown of the relationship between Mia and Jade and the brother.
Yeah.
Then how they're keeping this from the parents. It's a very sort of strange play on narrative, because it doesn't really fit the classic structure of the horror film either. Also, it sounds, as you can hear it there, it's played completely straight in tone, but there's these moments of kind of wackiness and silliness. Yeah. Like they have a dog that just walks around the place like farting, and you know, they constantly comment on how smelly he is, and you know, like some of the huge plot points happen in these really quick montages, and then you'll have big scenes of dialogue, of banter. So I kind of think that speaks a lot to the filmmakers, because they're obviously not like traditionally trained filmmakers. They're two YouTubers that have a huge following, and that would have made these very wacky types of horror films.
So is there enough substance in it to transfer to the big screen? And I suppose if it is a horror, are we frightened, or is there something else? It sounds as if there's kind of a mix of genres involved here.
Yeah, like it's played completely straight. It does tackle these really dark themes of grieving, of loss, of mental illness. Now, it doesn't delve deep or authentically into any of those. It just kind of sits on that surface level. Now, we will say there's just amazing performances in the young cast, and Sophie Wilde really sells the drama on it. I'd say if they didn't have her, you would have been
in real trouble.
But what it does have is this absolute earnestness in the filmmaking. Like, you can tell in the film that these filmmakers have just enjoyed making films, every second of it, that they love horror, that this is from the heart in an authentic way that you can't mimic or fake.
Right, okay. So, star, is it worth seeing, and stars?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing first feature. It's people have really reacted very well to it. It has a following. I would say 3.5 stars, and I would say they're in line to get a big budget.
You want to see more from these two filmmakers who Chris does know.
I just want to see it, Sean.
Yeah, you just want to see it. Okay, we'll come back to you when you've done that. Let us move on to film number 3, The Beanie Bubble, based on a non-fiction book called The Great Beanie Baby Bubble. The Beanie Bubble chronicles the 1990s craze for soft toys known as the Beanie Babies from toy maker Ty Warner. Tell us a bit, Chris, about Ty Warner. Did you have a Beanie Baby bubble?
I never had a Beanie Baby. No, I had Turtle toys, but not Beanie Babies. But even if you've never heard of Ty Warner, you'll be familiar with his toys. You'll be familiar with the Ty toy brand, which were, you know, this alarmingly simple line of children's, you know, of stuffed children's playthings, usually in animal form. And they were filled with pellets. They weren't filled the whole way up like a traditional stuffed toy. So that kind of made them, you know, a little bit, you know, cuter and you know, great for smaller kids. But it wasn't smaller kids that were buying them in the mid-90s. It was adults, because they were sold this idea that they were collectible toys in a way. And this was at a time when, you know, people were buying up computers. You had like 18 million Americans online. They were getting used to something called eBay, and they were reselling on these Beanie Babies to, you know, avid collectors for like extortionate prices. So this was a huge investment. It wasn't just a children's plaything. But of course, supply soon caught up with demand. You had a billionaire who, you know, thought a little too much of himself in charge of all of this. So eventually the bubble was going to burst. So this film kind of tells this story about this icky billionaire who kind of, you know,
The rise and fall, who kind of
messed everyone over, you know, on his quest to kind of be the most powerful, you know, toy man in America, basically.
So that's Ty Warner, and played by Zach Galifianakis in this particular piece. Sarah Snook then is Sheila. Who is she, Gemma?
So Sheila is a single mum who Ty Warner takes a liking to when she stands up to him. What's very funny is he picks women that I think there's some vulnerable edge to them, and then ingratiates himself into their lives. Now, these women aren't actually real women. They're apparently composites of characters in the book that this film was adapted from. But she's somebody that, you know, he really takes a liking to, and he starts to love bomb her after she rejects him. To the point where he refuses not to be in a relationship, which, I mean, it's in the first instance, that's a huge red flag as to...
Yeah, absolutely, right. So Sarah played by... Sheila, rather, played by Sarah Snook, and Zach Galifianakis as Ty. And she's been waiting for him for hours to discuss light fittings for his new house, and here is the moment when he finally decides he'll show up, kinda.
Lights, right? I'll be right with you.
The UK is a mess, and it's not my fault.
And the last thing I would do is to hire incompetent partners. Excuse me, what are you doing?
Do you often keep people waiting 3 hours?
It has been a
hectic... Because I told my sick daughters I'd be back as quick as I could, and then I waited here for longer than a human should.
I run a company that's highly unpredictable.
Okay, but I know you're busy, and I know you're rich, but I also know that life is too short to waste on assholes, so please move your car, or I'll move it for you less gently. I got better places to be.
Do not stay on the phone when somebody is waiting for you. It is bad manners, Ty. That's like Galifianakis and Sarah Snook as Sheila in a scene from The Beanie Bubble. This is just a dramatization then of this story, Chris. Does it work as that?
I don't think so. I think as a drama, I thought it just lacked depth and conviction. And then as a comedy, because it's a dramedy, as a comedy, then, you know, the jokes weren't sharp enough. And like, I can't blame the performer. Zach Galifianakis, he does kind of resemble a performer who maybe showed up to the wrong party, but just decided to stick around anyway. You're kind of thinking, you're not really right for this material, but you're giving it a fair go anyway. Elizabeth Banks, as is always the case with her, she's the star performer.
Elizabeth Banks is there as well as Sarah Snook.
Yes, she is. Yeah. Yeah, she is playing the character who is said to, again, you're not really sure what's true and what's made up in this film. I mean, the film even begins at one of those lines where it says, there are parts of the truth you just can't make up, the rest we did. And actually, that line should give you an idea of the kind of writing involved here, because this film...
Yeah, it's kind of a smart disclaimer, isn't it?
It's full of all these things that kind of sound smart, but when you start to think of them, it's just like, that doesn't really mean anything. Some of the performers aren't really served that well. I just found the flipping back and forth between timelines a little bit annoying. It was kind of killing the momentum for me a little bit. So
stars.
I thought, you know, look, the performances are great. There's a good story here, but it's badly told. So I think 2 stars.
And what are you saying, Gemma?
Totally the absolute opposite of that.
I actually,
I felt like Zach Galifianakis was played Ty Warner as this absolute supervillain, where he projected himself as this really nice, vulnerable guy in the beginning. He wore these women down in this very sinister way by playing a character, and then would let the mask drop very, very subtly, like a narcissist, because like this like absolute shambles of a man, he ruled this company terribly. I think the fact that he's not the star of the show, he's the antagonist, and these three women, it's their arcs, it's their story, and it's the cost and what it took to break away from him. And I loved the non-linear storytelling, because I just felt it showed the kind of the needles and threads and how there's a spool from this man's toxicity that kind of goes out into the further community and the effects of it. So I thought it was really well, that was really well realised. And I gave a 4.
A solid 4 from you. So a big difference of opinion in terms of the Beanie Bubble there, which is on limited release. And then it comes, it's on Apple TV Plus actually from today. And I should have said also that our middle film, Talk to Me, is in films, or is in cinemas rather, from today. Gemma Cray and Chris Wassers are 2 reviewers on this Friday evening. And so to our album reviews then. 4 albums for consideration this evening. Pat Carty and Andrea Cleary have been listening to them. 8 years on from their last reunion album, Blur released The Ballad of Darren. Darren is the band's longtime bodyguard, Darren Smoggy Evans. We spoke to Kevin Rowland on Tuesday about Dexy's The Feminine Divine. That's the second of it. Well, it'll be the first of our albums, in fact. And in order to soundtrack film's biggest summer blockbuster, Barbie producer Mark Ronson has assembled pop stars Nicki Minaj, Sam Smith, Haim, Dua Lipa and others for Barbie the album. And American rockers Greta Van Fleet bring us their 3rd studio album, Star Catcher, I beg your pardon. Let's go to, I'm going to start with Dexys, because we did speak at length with Kevin Rowland on Tuesday's programme about this album. Give us the setup. It's essentially a concept album, this, Pat.
Is it?
Yes, it's a story of a young man.
I think about, when I listened to it, I thought it was him. So you're telling me maybe he's writing a song about someone else. I thought it was him reflecting on his life and saying, listen, I have come to the conclusion that I haven't been the nicest I could have been to the people around me, to the women in my life, and I was adhering to an idea of manhood that maybe was false and maybe had caused problems, and this is a kind of a almost like a therapy session for him, where he comes out and says, yeah.
Yes, it is. Of course, like all artists, it is him, but it's a bit more, slightly indirect. It's a kind of a fictional version of him, but it is his story, Andrea. Is it a worthwhile arc for us to be following across the album?
Look, I love Kevin. I really do, and I really wanted to like this.
It's not me, it's you. I hear it coming.
But look, I mean, look, it's definitely a concept album, and the concept is women, and it's a new concept, I think, to Kevin as you see throughout the album. It's worthwhile him having these conversations with himself and with the people around him and the women in his life. I just don't know if the rest of us need to be subjected to it. But it's, I say that with a lot of love in my heart for Kevin Rowland, who I've been a fan of for many years, but this, Kevin, was a misstep.
Okay. Well, listen, the album is called The Feminine Divine. Let's have a listen to a little bit from that title track, and a language warning from the very start here, because the language does get fairly rough fairly quickly on most of the tracks, and certainly on The Feminine Divine.
I've been thinking about my life. I know that some things I did, they just don't seem right, and I didn't know what I know today. I am a different person in every way.
So there we go, a little bit of the Feminine Divine title track from Dexys and Kevin Rowland. And I have to defend him here. Both of you are clearly annoyed at him for some reason.
Look, not him.
He may have been late coming to the realisation around this, but he has come to a realisation around his treatment of women, and he's put it on an album to say, my fault.
Okay, right. That's...
So I'll come to Andrea's nodding head in a minute, right. But you're going to come back first, Pat.
I'm agreeing with you to a certain extent. Of course that's a good thing to come to these realisations. The problem
I know it's 2023.
The problem is, it's just not a great record, you know? The songs aren't great. There's the sound that comes on in the very first song, the sound comes on, and it sounds kind of, it sounds thin. It sounds like keyboardy, where before Dexys had these bright, you know, full-bodied horns. Maybe it's the way it's recorded. Maybe it's the way it's produced. Maybe that's not Kevin Rowland's fault. Later on, when he gets to a song called My Goddess Is, okay, which is a thing that maybe Prince could have carried off. Maybe, you know, maybe. But it doesn't really, it doesn't work for him.
So and, it's not just the theme, it's the actual music you're giving out about.
But that's nothing compared, that's a masterpiece compared to Goddess Rules when it gets to that, which sounds like some sort of nightmare in S&M club, you know, with your one giving orders to him and all that.
And
it didn't work for me anyway.
Andrea, you were nodding vigorously, despite the fact that I presume you're wearing dungarees in honour of Kevin Rowland tonight.
I absolutely am. I wore them in his honour. Look, yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. The music isn't anything to write home about, but my problems with this record are that I was excited the first song is a song that was written back in 1991 that was the message of which is I want to protect my lady because I love her and she needs protection and so on, and then the rest of the album is him kind of responding to him having written that song and reflecting on the kind of sexual politics of that. And then you get to a song like My Goddess Is, which just seems to kind of try to subvert gender dynamics in a way where, you know, my goddess is the sexiest girl I know, and this goddess figure is someone who's spending all the time on the phone to her friends, and she's forcing him to help her get ready to go out, and it's this representation of women that is so bizarre and
naive,
at odds with what the message was supposed to be.
Stars from you, Andrea, and I know it's going to hurt you to do this.
It's a cringeworthy album. I'm so sorry. It's 1.5 stars.
Pat, even you are doing a sharp intake of breath.
There was one song on it, My Submission, which I thought was okay, but the rest is very poor. I completely agree with what Andrea said, but whatever about the lyrical content or whatever, the songs just aren't very good in my opinion.
Right.
2 out of 5.
2 out of 5 for the Feminine Divine and Dexys. Now, we still have 3 albums to go: Blur, Barbie, the soundtrack from Barbie, and Greta Van Fleet, and Arash Leshon Glor. Indeed, we are back with the programme and the 3 albums that we have left to look at: Blur, Barbie, and Greta Van Fleet. Let's go to Blur. Damon Albarn, get the time. Where does he get the time? Mm. One might ask. I think it's safe to say on this one, Pat. Gorillaz, writing operas, and now regrouped with his own band to create The Ballad of Darren. Introspective and a little sad, this one, I think it's fair to say, Pat.
Yeah, that's not the first time, I suppose, Blur have done that.
No.
There's a lot of songs on it that reminded me of the kind of... Stay with me now. Nostalgia for an alternative now that you would hear on the Good, the Bad and the Queen albums, which is another side project of his. I mean, I think Damon Albarn is a bit of a genius, to be honest with you. There's the Good, the Bad and the Queen. He made a brilliant album with Two Man and Diabate called Mali Music. He seemed to have done that, you know, in a half an hour. And then there's Gorillaz, and then there's these Blur albums. And any Blur record, I think, is a cause for celebration. I mean, the announcement that they were playing shows, they were brilliant out in Malahide. And this, you know, without giving the game away too early, is a great record.
Yeah, and is there a true... there is a sad story behind all of this, Andrea. Is there? No. I've made... Oh, you don't know at all. Okay. Well, talk to me about what you think he's doing musically.
I think musically, I was talking to somebody recently about it. They asked me how I felt about it, and I said it's a similar feeling to when the Arctic Monkeys released Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, in that it feels like a grown-up record by a grown-up band. And it can feel like a bit of a sharp turn if you're mostly just listening to the first two records. But there is that through line if you follow each of them and their careers separately, and not just Damon, but the rest of them as well. You can see them having kind of come back together here as grown-ups, and yeah. It's reflective, and of course it's sad. You get a bit sad. It's like when you haven't seen your friends for a while, you all get together, you catch up, but then at some point in the night things turn a bit nostalgic and you start talking about school, and that's what this feels like. And it feels like that, but there's a real beauty in that, and I think that they're at the stage in their careers now, and Damon especially, where he doesn't feel the need to wrap everything up in a wink. There's not a whole lot of jokes on this album. There's not a whole lot of humour, and that's something that I thought I would want from it, but actually it would have jarred completely.
Well, let's listen to the opening track, which is called The Ballad, and I think this would give us a sense of the, I'm saying sad, but maybe nostalgia is actually
melancholic.
The word. Melancholic. Okay. Let's have a listen to the ballad.
I just look to my life, and all I saw was that you're not coming back. Oh, can't you see?
Now, when you listen to that track, you can see why I had totally misunderstood what The Ballad of Darren was all about. I presumed poor old Darren was in a bad way, in some way, shape or form. But in fact, Pat, you were telling me the story as we were listening to that song.
Well, Darren's grand.
I heard on the showbiz grapevine, Sean, that actually Darren, who you mentioned in your intro, who's Damon Albarn's bodyguard.
Yes.
Had heard an early demo of this song that's been knocking around for a while, and he kept encouraging his boss to finish it. So that's where, as far as I know, the name The Ballad of Darren comes from.
So it's basically, it's a little homage to his bodyguard.
Will that do, writing it down at the last minute? I mean, I suppose it shouldn't give us a wrong impression of the overall sound of the album. The sound that comes after it, St. Charles Square, even has an oi at the start of it. And to me, it sounds like Scary Monsters, Bowie. There's a song on Scary Monsters where it's no game, where he's screaming and shouting. And Graham Coxon, who's a brilliant guitarist, does his best Adrian Belew, Robert Fripp impression behind it. And also The Heights that closes the album. Bit of an echo of Where Are We Now from Bowie as well. That kind of sadness, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I can't remember which of the songs is the third. Can't see the playlist in front of me now, but the third or fourth song down into it, there was a real sound of Beatles harmonies in there as well, which gave me a real sense of nostalgia, Andrea.
Yeah, the arrangements on it are very, very beautiful. I mean, the ballad has this very cinematic, spacious instrumentation. The Narcissist as well, which is, I think, far and away the best song on the record and one of the best songs of the year. A perfect reintroduction to the band. It was the first song that we'd heard from them from this record. The Everglades is another great song that just has these beautiful, sorrowful, mournful chords, but that has all this hope, and the line in it, "We're growing tall with the pain," which is something you can only write if you're a certain age and looking back at your life and your career and your work with your friends. It's really wonderful stuff.
All right, I just want of a little splash of The Narcissist before we go to Stars.
Looked in the mirror, so many people standing there. I walked towards them into the floodlight.
That's just a little bit of The Narcissist from Blur and the new album, The Ballad of Darren. And I was saying Vintage Blur as we listened to that. Is the album Vintage Blur, is it well worth listening to, Pat, and Stars?
Every Blur album is great. Even the first one that isn't great is kind of great. So I would give it a very strong 4 stars. And the reason I'm not giving it 5 is because I was warned on the show before not to give 5 stars. So 4.
Okay. All right. What are you saying, Andrea?
I'm saying that I don't want to get through a review of this album without mentioning how excellent Graham Coxon is across the album and just how wonderful it is to hear him and Damon back together again. So it's 4 stars for me as well.
4 stars from you too. All right, let us move on to Greta Van Fleet. Who are Greta Van Fleet, as opposed to who is, as the name suggests, Andrea?
They are made up of three brothers and their pal who bonded over classic rock and the blues and listened to Led Zeppelin for most of their lives, and that's exactly what they sound like.
Yeah. I fear this
made
may
up,
be a short
made up
review.
Is a good phrase there. Okay. I think, because, you know.
Runaway blues. Runaway blues. Let's hear what that sounds like.
You know what I'm talking
I'm not going to go the full 1 minute and 17 seconds of that song. I'm going to take it out at 1 minute and 2 seconds. Is that give us a good sense of what this album is, Pat? And well, I think that both of you are going to give out yards about it.
I'm going to give out yards, and I'm not going to give out yards at the same time. So bear with me. The Runaway Blues there, right? That's the best thing on the album by a mile, I think.
Right. Okay.
And it's only 1 minute, 17 seconds long. And so they do that, but then they have stuff like The Archer. Right, and first think about that title, and of course it mentions Sauron in the lyrics, so you know you're on a loser there for a start, you know. And then there's the frankly ridiculous Meeting the Master, which is a hippie mess that goes on for about 5 minutes, you know. So if they're more like that, as Andrea was saying, Led Zeppelin, right, just because you sound like something that's great doesn't mean you're great yourself. The Cult used to make albums in the 80s that sounded a bit like Zeppelin, but they had a kind of a glint in their eye. Okay. And they had better songs.
So these guys do take themselves very seriously, do they, Andrea?
Oh, they don't even have the decency to have a sense of humour about this. Like, I'm a fan of the darkness. I'm a fan of having a bit of fun with this kind of sound. But they take this so, so seriously. So it's at the point where, like, when you're listening to the record, you might hear a good guitar line and you might say to yourself, like, yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah. But it's not theirs. They're okay. Just they're trying to do as much as they can get away with without being sued by a better band.
Okay, okay, free. I'm afraid to ask stars.
1.5 for Dexys wasn't my lowest of the week. This is a dreadful waste of time. 1 star.
A dreadful waste of time. 1 star.
It's terrible. And also, if it was on in the car, I'd be drumming.
You were
like
playing
I was
air
right
drums
yeah.
a minute
but
ago.
But I'd be thinking I should drive home and listen to a Led Zeppelin record.
Exactly.
I'll give it stars. 2 out of 5.
You're giving it 2 out of 5. All right. Let us move on then. We had the Feminine Divine earlier on. Now we have Barbie, the other Feminine Divine. Yes. Let's start with them to cleanse our palates. A little bit of Lizzo.
Out of bed and wave to my homegirls. Hey, Barbie.
Hey.
She's so cool. All dolled up, just playing chess by the pool. Come on, we got important things to do.
Okay, wonderful to see, as I said earlier on, that Andrea came in her dungarees for Dexys, and Pat, that pink is gorgeous on you for this Barbie item, I have to say. It's hard not to smile even as you listen to that. Mark Ronson, has he compiled previous tracks? Has he asked the people involved to make new tracks? What is the soundtrack here, Andrea?
So he was approached by Greta Gerwig to create the sound for the film and the sound was supposed to be, what is it, Peloton Pop, which I think you can hear a little bit in that track, but definitely you can hear it in Dua Lipa's track. And so the film was filmed and scenes were shown to the various artists on it, which include Lizzo, Dua Lipa, Nicki Minaj, Ice Spice, Charlie XCX, Billie Eilish, basically the biggest women in pop, with the two notable exceptions of Beyonce and Taylor Swift. And that each artist was asked to kind of write their response and their feeling to the scene. But it's important to note about that Lizzo song, that is a diegetic song in the film. So if it sounds a bit on the nose and a bit, you know, she's a narrator in that moment
it's happening as part of the action on the film itself. But that in itself is a bit of fun. And even if you haven't seen the film, which neither you or I have just yet.
I haven't,
but without having seen the film,
yeah,
is it still a joy across the soundtrack?
I think that, listen, I don't think this all works by any stretch of the imagination. Mm. But then, of course, you're making a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe it all works if I'm sitting watching the film, which I'm sure is great. I haven't seen Oppenheimer either, but I'll get around to both of them, I will. But that is great. The Dua Lipa song is great. Love the Billie Eilish song. But there's other stuff there that, you know, is autopilot. Mm. What they did with Aqua's Barbie, which is an abominable song, but of course that you can't ignore. And then your one comes in and stomps all over it, and it sounds like a bit of an auto-tuned nightmare.
Who comes in and stomps all over it?
It's Nicki Minaj.
Why does everybody have to be called a bitch? I don't understand that. Never understood that.
That's within the lyrics of the song.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just it doesn't. A lot of it sounds like video game
but
stuff to
me. You know, you were saying, even as we were saying, listen to the Lizzo song, Andrea, that, you know, that's a diegetic song. It's part of the action. Mm. Do you need to really have seen the film to appreciate the soundtrack fully?
I think some of it. I mean, I think the Barbie World song is used quite well in the film. Yeah, similarly, Charlie XCX's song, which I think is one of the best songs on its speed drive, is a highlight within the film.
The Hey Mickey
and
one?
It's it's the kind of like power pop Charlie track. It's great in the film, really hyperactive, very sweet as well. And I think it's great on the soundtrack itself. Billie Eilish was given the brief to write Barbie's Heart song, and it is like it's probably the only kind of ballad on this. It's so outrageous. Beautiful. I'm very surprised if she's not nominated.
A little bit of that before I get the stars from you. You can hear the ballad's quality already.
I used to float, now I just fall down dry.
I have to say that sounds lovely, even just that little bit of that we got. So, Pat, you can talk about it. You only know this as a soundtrack.
Yeah.
Does it work as an album? Because that's what we're reviewing.
No, not for me. But, I mean, some of it does. But then that's like all compilation albums, I suppose. Some of it does. You know, that song you played, that's beautiful. And as I said, I love the pink one, or the Lizzo one. It's probably not aimed at a middle-aged man. So maybe I'm not the best person to judge it.
Stars?
2.5.
Two and a half. Okay, what are you saying, Andrea?
I think it works really well in the film, but any soundtrack this is going to feel very disjointed as an album. It's best listened to after you've seen the film, definitely. As an album or as a soundtrack?
As an album.
3.5.
3.5, okay. So that's 6 and 12. Do you know that you gave the 4 albums out of 40 got 21, which sometimes 3 albums out of 30 would get 21. I don't think it's been a good week for albums. All right, you're going to stay with us because as the week finishes up, we want to pay homage, of course, to Sinead O'Connor. Now, I said that we wanted to finish the programme this evening by paying some kind of tribute to Sinead O'Connor. It seems 2 nights ago was when the announcement was made. I was flabbergasted and, you know, didn't know what to say on Wednesday night when the news broke through, Pat. But the kind of outpouring that there's been since Wednesday evening tells us a lot about the respect and the place which Sinead O'Connor had in this country, in music and in terms of the overall culture of the country as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think for people of a certain age, my age anyway, when she came along in the 80s, you know, Ireland was still, in the 80s, Ireland was still in the 50s, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And to wake up from the slumber, and she was one of the people who just stood up against all that and campaigned tirelessly. You know, I'm not, that was one part of her. And also then there was the music. But my point being that there was an artist, a proper artist who stood up and didn't care about, you know, commercial concerns, because we know what happened with the Saturday Night Live thing and everything, where she basically torpedoed her own career in America to make a point. And it turns out she was right. And that has been mentioned before. But the reaction, I mean, has just been, I think it's nearly more about her place in society than the music, perhaps. You know?
And you were saying, even as we were talking about it during the ad break, Andrea, that you're not even sure if it has hit you fully yet.
No, I don't think so. I saw the news and I was so detached from it. I read it as a news story, and then I was talking to my partner and I was explaining to him what Sinead has kind of meant to me over the years with her music, but also just being an Irish millennial woman, I owe a lot to her. We all owe a lot to her for, you know, paving a path for how you stand up for injustice in society, no matter what area you work in. If you work in the arts, you know, if you, no matter what you're doing in society, that you have that power. And she gave a lot of women that power and voice. But I was explaining all this to my partner that night, and it was then that I got upset, you know. But there's something about it; it just hasn't. It doesn't feel right.
And the reaction that you've been listening to, are you surprised at, in any way, by the outpouring of emotion around it all?
Yes and no. I mean, I knew that it would hit a lot of my friends and people in my circle really hard. A lot of, you know, prominent Irish feminists online have been speaking beautifully about the impact that she's had on Irish women. But I think it's the global aspect of it. You know, there's a lot of wrongs being righted now in a lot of people's minds. And as you said, she was right, and she was right about everything.
She has been proven, absolutely. Yeah. Well, listen, we will leave the last words to Sinead O'Connor this evening. But before we go, let me tell you that tonight's programme was researched by Paula Shields and Amandine Passo-Devine. Leon Dunn was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And the programme was produced by Reg Luby. But Fonamage in the Focal Jarnock, the Sinead and Nocht, Souvenus Sherry, Art Sinead.
Because songs can be personal or otherwise, but when I was standing there singing that song, certainly at the beginning of it, I never do this because it's corny, but to imagine that you're singing to an audience, or you have a message, or you have any right to have a message and start preaching to an audience or telling them anything. But I actually did have a sense I was talking to women and girls, that I was actually saying, look, there's something about us, something really important here to get discovered. That, you know, men are wonderful, and I adore men, and so I don't mean it in a bad way at all, but that often women, you know, you can run your whole life around projecting all this stuff onto fellas, you know, and you don't know it's you you're longing for. And I suppose fellas must probably do the same thing. I don't know why I had a sense I was singing it to girls, really, probably youngish girls. I don't know why, but there you go.